Adventures in Glass, written and read by Fresney, Fandom Sherlock BBC, part of the Variations on the Equation series, Warnings for Omegaverse. The currents of conversation flowed through the Doge's garden party. The great of serene Venice withdrawing to a cool retreat from the fetid stench of the city in summer. Father Moriarty idly followed the currents of conversation. Signore Andretti was scandalized by the nature of society again. It is not right that Provosto Franco take up with Provosto Carelli. They are both betas. The only reason for coupling is within the blessing of wedlock during heat. His wife, Donna Lucretia Andretti, smiled somewhat stiffly at his side. What made that remark especially amusing was that Signore Andretti's lover, the widow Donna Rosaria Donova, was standing not 5 feet away from him, attempting not to murder her fan. Certainly the poetess, Provosta Arena Edle, thought it amusing. She wafted her fan in front of her face. She verged on violation of sumptuary laws with her colorful high panniered skirts, like that of an Omega. But then, what Provosta of Venice did not sail the edge of that law? That her low bodice displayed a web of diamonds from one of her patrons was a law more would have liked to have broken. Andretti, I'm surprised at you. Provosta Alde smiled, in that all of us, be we signore or signora, provosto or provosta, dono or, she smiled at Donna Rosario, Donna, we are capable of finding pleasure in coupling out of heat. So it must be God's plan that it be so. Otherwise, like the cats of Venice, we'd only cry out when God wants us to be fruitful and multiply. In fact, she waved her fan across her face, in that we are made in God's image. It rather makes me consider the curse God's bollocks in an entirely new way. Elegant Signora Lestrade closed her fan and turned it to signify a well-played cut. Her lover, Provosta Maria Hupa, blushed. Signore Andretti blushed for an entirely different reason. You border on sacrilege! Border? Provosta Alde smiled. Perhaps like Caesar, I stride into it. Provosta Alde played a dangerous game, to flirt so with sacrilege. Venice could turn on a whisper of plague. Perhaps she deemed herself safe for half a season, having but lately convinced the King of France to lend Venice some of his ships against the Turks, after a very private poetry reading that had the King sitting tenderly for 3 days later. She flitted her eyes at Father Moriarty. What say you, Father? Is it a sin for two betas to couple, with no bond allowed them by ecclesiastic law, as there is no heat? It was a very convenient rumor that he had taken Captain Morano of the Night Guard as his lover. Convenient to hide far more interesting affairs. He smiled mildly. As Donna Eva came from the rib of Signore Adamo, Donna should cleave to Signore. As Eva ate the knowledge of good and evil, so God laid heat upon her. Donna and Signore, Father, you seem to be leaving out Donna and Signora. Tell me, are you a secret Protestant? Provosta Alde played a dangerous game indeed, but then, as far as she knew, he was but a simple priest. He smiled genially. Not at all, my child. As God said, I am the Alpha, and I am the Omega. Provosta Alde made a moue of her painted lips. As I said, then, We are made in God's image. The party laughed, and Father Moriarty kept his smile on as a painted cloth may conceal a gaping hole in the wall of a fine palazzo. God as Alpha and Omega, leaving no room for Beta, not even allowed for, not even considered by the Council of Nicaea. No, he was no Protestant, preferring Donna and Signore as elect. No, a Beta born in a gutter, he'd made a far more reasonable turn. If God did not want him, then he would turn to Lilith, Provosta and Provosto, mother of monsters with no heat, goddess of Betas. He would cleave to her and observe her rites. All this he thought in the flicker of an eyelash and a genial smile. Donna Rosaria snarled, "Why don't we ask our peculiar newcomer from Granada, Provosta Holmia, who is here to teach us glassmaking? Show my cousins the Muranos how it's done. Puh! We were talking about the coupling of Betas, Holmia. What do you think on the matter?" She did not like Provosta Holmia, who by her gender could have what was denied Donna Rosaria. Provosta Holmia of Granada, dressed in a Beta black, unpanniered gown of Spanish style, glanced up from the scrap of paper where she was rapidly sketching a hummingbird. "I was attempting to ignore this tedious conversation." The hummingbird flew on to other flowers. "Ah, fine." She put her delicately drawn sketch into the scuffed leather satchel at her waist. "If coupling were a glass that I'd cast, then I'd melt it down and start again. In heat there is no clarity, and in coupling outside of heat there is no point." "Spoken like a Beta," quipped Provost Alde. Father Moriarty sipped his Prosecco, the better to conceal the deliciousness of that remark. Signore Andoretti's bonded declared that she was overheated, and they went to cool themselves in the grape arbor. Donna Rosaria followed soon after, and their group dispersed, which left Father Moriarty and Provost Alde to chat and make amused glances at Provost Holmia as she darted from flower to flower making sketches. Father Moriarty had another reason for amusement. Provost Holmia, with her rigorously proper Beta garb, and yet, for such a tall Beta, her center of gravity was quite low. There, too, her perfume of sandalwood and a trace of cat's musk, an old Roman harlot's trick for obscuring presented scent. He'd had a follower break into her home to steal the hair from her comb, and smiled to see it burn blue in the flame of a black candle, after being doused in a solution of aqua naturalia and the blood of a black goat under the light of unholy Lilith's star, blue for Omega. For a Donna such as Holmia to pretend to be a Beta, to violate sumptuary laws by wearing the clothes of a Beta, to speak before the Venetian Senate as a Beta could do, to sign contracts, to own property and own a business. These actions were illegal before the city, and a sin before God. Father Moriarty cultivated the knowledge of such things, more delicious because it made her vulnerable. Such a clever, vulnerable creature could be valuable to Father Moriarty. Father Moriarty bid his farewells soon after. He had places to be, black masses to plan, sacrifices to make, plots to twist the elite of Venice to the greater glory of Lilith. In that moment, he loved his home with her municipal brothels and casual disregard for all but profit and pleasure. There was no place he'd rather be. He didn't entirely lose attention on Provosta Holmia. He simply had other concerns. Oh, he gossiped now and again on her strange goings-on. There were the stories of Provosta Holmia and her partner, Signore Vatti, running up and down the streets of Venice, gathering chromatic materials from the urchins. He You did have to admire their landlady's nerve, given the number of explosions that emitted from their workshop on Baker's Island. There would also, perhaps, have been stories of a strange rite or three observed in the marshes, had there been anyone to observe it. There were tales of Provosta Holmia and her Signore Vates, ever more splendid commissions to the glory of the church, city, and wealthy citizen. Tiled glass so well made that the images within it seemed to move and live. Also, the nine-day wonder that was their shipwreck for 9 days on an island in the Adriatic. But they were rescued, and none thought much of it. No one remarked on the arrest of a Jew for murder. That he was hung was justice. Father Moriarty gathered the dirt under the hanged man on the night of the dark moon, and in the dark there was nothing to see. It was a slow week in May when Provosta Holmia abruptly changed her style of dress from her usual tightly cinched Spanish severity to a more Venetian style, with full high waists, which gave the Venetians something to discuss other than the shade of scarlet that Provosta Alde had been seen wearing to mass the week before. Provosta Alde did remark to Father Moriarty that he seemed tired of late, but his only reply was that he had so very much to do, tending to his flock, which was true. There was a rather delicious scandal when Provosta Holmia's twin sister, Donna Seforda, descended upon that household heavy with child. It was generally agreed that Donna Seforda was unlikely to be a widow. Rather more likely, she was a harlot, or had been seduced into being a harlot, in Rome more likely. The Venetians liked to think about harlotry in Rome. Though some say she married Signor Vati, who, being unable to marry the sister that he loved, had settled on her Omega sister, a situation that those who believed it to be true all agreed was tragic and to be pitied. Provosta Hupa declared that it was only reasonable that Donna Seforda live separate from their household under those circumstances. Father Moriarty smiled to think of what rude coupling between Provosta Holmia and her Alpha must have occurred, perhaps while stranded on that island, to bring such a pregnant to pass. Provosta Holmia had sailed too close to danger, it would seem, and now bore the price of it. The Society of Venice congratulated themselves on their perceptions. When Donna Seforda disappeared soon after the birth, leaving her child in her sister's Beta home. Now, since glass-making did little to interfere with Father Moriarty's plans, he watched their antics as mainly an amusement. He gathered his flock to him, that they might plan their own special rites upon Midwinter's night. He rather thought he might have plans for a bastard child of a profaning Donna at that celebration. As it happened, he perhaps should have paid more attention to Provosta Alde, and not gossip about a glassmaker. As it happened, Provosta Alde was an agent of the See of Rome, investigating certain dark rumors in Venice. With but an hour's warning, Father Moriarty fled Venice with his clothing and little more. He finally alighted in Amsterdam and set to his business there, and had little reason to follow the adventures of Provosta Holmia and her Alpha. Given the ongoing pursuit of Provosta Alde, he had other problems. As to Provosta Charlotte Holmia at the garden party, she'd been very sure of her guise as a Beta. It was the gender that she far preferred to the one she'd been cursed with. When her father had shown her the betrothal papers, after her presentation at 13, she had broken all the furniture in her room. Her elder brother urged caution. He was made of caution. But it was he who had given her the clothing, perfume, and the funds to take flight that night. He'd said, "If I do not see you to a safe place, who knows where you will alight? Who knows where you will alight?" She had taken his charity grudgingly, but where there was need, there could not be pride. She'd apprenticed herself in Granada to a master glassmith. Now, while she could craft glass as well as any other, her interests lay in the color of glass, the way it could be applied naturally from materials within the glass, or painted on within and without in layers of imagery. It was in this contemplation of color that Signora Michela Straforda walked up to her at the party of the Doge, followed by a slight alpha of unassuming mien. Signora Straforda said, "Good morn, Provosta Homia! This is my friend, Signore Giovanni Vatti." Charlotte looked Signore Vatti up and down. She said, "I am out of paper for my sketches. May I borrow some?" Signora Straforda laughed and patted her balloon pantaloons. "I do not carry any." Signore Vatti bobbed his head. "I keep a scrap of leather you can use." He handed the leather over. Provosta Holmia turned it over in her hands and quickly sketched a line or ten of the image of a rose thick with bees. She said, "You are a master glassmith. Were you trained in the house of Altari or Savona?" Signore Vatti's eyebrows rose. "Savona? But how did you know?" "You wear your hose in the Livonian style. You have burns on your wrists, consistent with a glassblower, and the injury to your shoulder is consistent with that craft. You were cast out by your former employer because he considered your hands unsteady for such work. I call such an alpha an idiot." She tossed a small glass ball from her pouch at him. He caught it handily. "As I said, an idiot. I commented to Signora Straforda that I needed a partner, but that no one would work with me because I am neither Venetian nor an alpha." Provosta Alde made an amused moo of her lips and waved her hand to indicate that was not the only reason. Provosta Holmia ignored her. As long as people remarked on her manner, they would not remark on other things. "And here, Signora Straforda brings me a glassmith, who, based on his lean cheeks and spattered shoes, is both unemployed and not from Venice." Signore Vatti licked his thin lips and said, "That's..." Charlotte braced herself for the usual abuse. "Amazing!" She felt as if a string had been cut. "That is not the normal response. What do people normally say?" asked Signore Vatti, smiling. Of course he smiled. He was a signore, out of work perhaps, but with all the world smiling on his endeavors. They normally make a sign to ward off a curse. Charlotte smiled thinly. "Yes, well, will you have me?" asked Signore Vatti, and wasn't that a loaded remark, if he but knew it. Charlotte was puzzled for a moment, and then realized her mistake. "Ah, I thought I had already offered you a share in the work, but perhaps not. If we are to work together, you should know my habits. I blow glass with my own pipes. I experiment extensively with color, and I am, as you observe, a beta." She curtsied stiffly. "If you wish for a position, come to my workshop on Baker's Island tomorrow." She held out her hand without hesitation. She was wearing gloves. She could afford to give that much away with a touch. "Tomorrow," said the rather dazed Signore Vatti. Charlotte charged off in pursuit of a bumblebee, or at least so she pretended. She'd invited an alpha into her home, into her place of work. This could be a disaster. She should send him away when he came calling the next day. He could not detect her scent, but she had breathed his, subtle and delicious as a feast. It filled her with such a yearning that she well knew he was one designed by nature and God to be a perfect match for her. He was a feast that she dared not eat, if she was to live the life that she desired. But then, she considered that her body was merely transport and subject to her will. She considered the look on his face and resolved to take him on the morrow. He moved into the quarters at the back of her home near the furnace. He blew and spun the glass and did not question her search for materials that would create the perfect red or the truest yellow. When her headlong pursuit found her captured by Turkish pirates, it was Signor Vati, who, like something in a tale, challenged the captain to a duel. It was thrilling to watch their blades flash in the sun, even as she secretly wondered if the Turkish captain really did know a good source for Tyrian purple. The way Signora Vati grinned and giggled with her after, as they sailed into port with their new ship, was a fearful delight. Not that they were allowed to keep the ship. Signora Lestrade confiscated it for Venice's fleet. Charlotte eased, foolishly perhaps, so much so in Signora Vati's company, that she showed him a project that she believed would bring their shop much wealth. He looked down upon the tray of glass rods and said, "They almost look like alpha phalluses." She glared down at her creations. "That was my intention." He laughed at her in the easiest manner. "They are too small. They look like what hangs off the statues of those unpresented boys the Florentines are always carving. I have never seen an Alpha's phallus, but consider the market. The city is full of Omegas, who every few months may have no access, but certainly in need of an Alpha phallus." She huffed, and then looked upon her new partner speculatively. "You have one. Let me see it." He coughed. "Provost Holmia, I..." She pulled back her shoulders and looked down the long line of her nose at him. "I am no Donna." The lie was sweet in her mouth. "Show me." She reached out, but he slapped her gloved hands away. He withdrew his phallus, and it did not seem much different from her rods. He sighed like a lidded pot on the fire. "It's not currently aroused." "Then arouse it." She crossed her arms. It was that or reach out and offer to aid the Alpha. He coughed again, and she knew, how could she of all people not, that even with her beta scent, he found her attractive. He ran his fingers lightly down the length of his member and said, "Provost Holmia, do you have a lover? An Alpha or a beta? Either would be fine." Seeing his fingers moving so upon himself, made her mouth water, for the musk of his scent was growing stronger as he lengthened before her. But Charlotte was made of sterner stuff. "Neither. And you should know that I consider myself married to my work. Now then, arouse it, for art and profit." His mouth took a downturn. She knew, how could she not, that he had hoped that this was her odd way of proposing to become his lover. She watched him and sketched him as he stroked himself, and it was astonishing the way his phallus grew and expanded, the expression on his face as he watched her watching him, the way his body tightened in release. She stole the cloth into which he came and put it into her trunk. She had him do it again on the morrow, as she was not certain of her sketches. They blew good solid glass, which indeed did sell very well to the Donos and Donnas of Venice. There was much conversation in certain quarters on her design. The ones in deep blue with the interior reservoir, painted with St. Valentine, were particularly popular. Provosta Alde, that sly cat, led a clapping salute when Charlotte went to make the rounds at her salon. But who could be your model? Still, a shame that you are a beta and can only bring the matter so far. Which really was a shame. as they ran about the streets and canals of Venice, ferreting out the best sources of materials for their wares, which was not all phalluses. Charlotte considered this. She thought about it as they sweated together, blowing glass by the fire. She knew he thought about some variation of it, as her cheeks hollowed as she blew. They shared a passion for glass. They even solved a mystery or two as they ran about Venice. Nothing complicated. Hands into the offering plate, and guild halls with petty conundrums in between glass installations. They shared everything. Work and home and sleepless nights, working on commissions. Even when they argued, heat in every sharp word, she knew it was because the beta nature she presented was false. Signore Vati was not being soothed by the scent of friendship, as he should be, were she actually a beta as she pretended. She thought about it while she sat unspeaking in morose thought in the workshop, staring out the open window. A few days before, the trial of a young signore and signora had ended. They had broken into the home of a donna and made free with her person. Their defense was that she had invited them in by opening her window to air out her linens. Their defense was that her scent had lured them within, a defense that proved adequate, as they had been released. Signore Vati placed a small glass, one of the delicate yellow goblets, full of sweet wine in front of her, careful as always to abide by her request, that he not touch her, for she'd claimed to dislike being touched out of piety. She did not say anything, but she sipped it and sighed as she looked out the open window at the quiet street outside. Baker's Island was her home now, somewhat apart from the other islands of Venice, but still part of it. She secretly thought about Signore Vati as her time approached, as she packed her belongings to go for her religious retreat to the convent of perpetual silence up the coast, as she lay in a convent cell, writhing like a cat in urgent need. She held the cloth in which her Giovanni, and how could she not think of him so, to her own nose as she eased a heavy glass rod, shaped like his phallus within her. She cried out his name as she pressed the reservoir that normally would inject fluid into her, and instead gathered it up. When she returned from her retreat, she had 3 small jars of the stuff and a mouth-watering longing for the feast awaiting in her home. She could not bring herself to say anything right away. In any case, there was the commission for the Madonna window in the Church of the Sacred Heart, and Madonna window for the private chapel of Provosta Hupa, also the Weaving Guild's commission for their guild hall. She and Signore Vati were sitting at their rest one evening, over winter mulled wine, when she brought out a jar. His breath caught in his throat, the sound like a barb to her ears. "Is that what I think it is?" "I cannot tell. Your conclusions from facts are frequently less clear than they should be, my dear Vati. But if you think it is the essence of an omega in heat, then you are correct." His much-observed brow furrowed. "But where did you get it?" His eyes went wide as a wound. "Is it that you have a secret Omega lover?" She cut off that line of thinking with a slash of her hand. "Do not be ridiculous. A commercial purchase, and no more." The lie came from her lips like breathing, like the borrowed scent that came off of her, and the clothing that she wore. "It does not matter." She pushed it across the table. "I think for the quality of our art and the profit of our business, you should apply this to your arousal." Her dear Giovanni, her Vati, her Alpha, needed no more encouragement than a smile from her. The difference in results was impressive. The smooth curve of the knot, the way he rutted into her gloved hands, because She needed for art to assist her Giovanni, the way he called out, Charlotte, as he came and came in her gloved hands into the cloth that she had prepared for this. Then, because she'd quite forgotten to sketch, they were forced to do it again in the morning in better light. Things became somewhat convoluted. If she so much as touched him with bare hands, she knew that she risked betraying her true nature. As it was, she was leaving behind clues all over their home, while her Giovanni, thinking he knew what she was, did not observe. Charlotte was very clever. However, when they used up the materials in the jars, and they cast the new line of phalluses for sale, it was only natural that she test the first of each set upon herself. If she insisted that her dear Giovanni watch her do so, it was for art's sake. If he stroked himself, while she stroked the heavy glass rod within her body, if she released warmed fluid from the reservoir inside her as he came, that was happenstance, or perhaps it was art, or perhaps it was business. Her personal collection of the phalluses was by this point somewhat extensive. Still, even sweltering over the fire, she had to remain swathed, lest he reach out to touch her. Their landlady, Provosta Hodzoni, would drop in and tut over Charlotte. "I don't know how you can stand it in there, covered in clothes, on a hot day like this." She'd pour watered limoncello, "just this once, dear." Charlotte went on retreat again, and repeated herself. This time pressed the phallus with a bladder replica of her Giovanni's knot inside, and screamed her Giovanni's name to the thick convent walls. She was not the only one who used this room for this purpose. She donated a well-washed selection of her collection to the convent, resolved to action. Action that she did not take. Not when they were briefly stranded on an island, and she swiftly counted the days until her next heat. Given that it was 30 days away, she could only compass fantasies of rutting with her Giovanni in the sand. Nor when they passed long days in each other's company at work. A week after the island, she was painting the blue curves of the Madonna's robes on a layer of glass. When her Giovanni cleared his throat, he said, I know that you claim not to be overly religious, but my observation of your actions..." She snorted, for any discussion that began so was sure to be wrong on Giovanni's part. "Your frequent retreat to a convent for religious contemplation, the way you are drawn to the Madonna as a subject for art, your strict observance of religious and sumptuary law for a beta says that you are very pious, and would not couple with another out of bond. Your piety keeps you from even touching my hand ungloved. You have entirely mistaken the matter." She packed as much incredulity into a look as could be done, and lobbed it at him, only to be shattered at his next words. "Please know that this life with you, I had nothing. I was without a place. The injuries to my shoulder had rendered me incapable of my craft, until you showed me newer and lighter techniques. Now I..." He pushed across the table a glass heart of deepest, purest red. "You already possess the original. And were it possible for an alpha and a beta to be wed, I would run out to declare the banns today if you would have me. Would you? Or is this entirely on my side, and my declaration unwanted?" His look was as naked as an unpainted pane of glass in the morning sun. She opened her mouth to lie as easy and necessary as breathing, and closed it again. She picked up his heart and held it up to the light. The red was true. She took off her right glove and then her left. She held his heart in her bare hands and kissed it, tasted for a moment what she thought might be a trace of him. She said,
"I have not been honest with you, but I have very much to lose. It seems simplest to put down his heart and kiss him."
She framed his face in her hands and finally tasted what she imagined for so many months. But Giovanni trailed off because he knew, but could not place the shattered pieces of knowledge into what he already thought he knew. "I am an Omega." She kissed him again sweetly. It was bittersweet. As she pulled away from him, he swallowed. That kiss was a farewell. He cast his eyes about the room. "Nothing needs to change. I'll tell no one." Her fingers tightened of their own accord around his dear, rumpled face.
"Do you think I could stay and not have you? And having had you, I could long resist coupling with you in heat."
She pulled away and would have turned to go, but then he snatched up the heart upon the table and would have flung it across the room. She stopped his hand. In that moment, she thought three things. The first was that it was only reasonable that she should go. The second was that she should pack up only the essentials and leave this instant. The third was that she was going nowhere.
"That's mine." She twisted the heart from his hand. "I want it, and I am keeping it. I am brilliant, and I will think of some way that I can have everything."
She held the heart firmly in her palm as she kissed him again, fierce and full of longing. One-handed, she plucked at the laces of his doublet, while he set to work with all speed to unlacing the fastenings of her gown. They twisted and tumbled to the floor of the workroom, uncaring of dust and clutter. They made a bed of their clothes and short work of each other. His scent had been a faint appetizer to the feast that was his touch. She clutched his heart in her hand as he slowly gave every attention to one breast and the other. She clutched his heart as she scratched at his back with her free hand. She marked her alpha. She clutched his heart as he, oh so slowly, pressed first the tip and then the whole of himself into her body. The odd sensation of something foreign to herself, filling her most pleasingly. Warm, or even the glass, when warmed with water, never was.
He said, "I love the way your eyes widen when I first push into you."
But
she would have protested, but that he pressed more firmly, turning her protest into a cry.
"You have been pushing me into you all these long months. Your eyes flutter when you first press me in, and your body adjusts to my girth."
He pulled slowly out. "You groan just like that when you pull me out." He pressed slowly back in, his alpha flesh rubbing in ways that glass had never done, and flaming her with the oils of his body, only to pant just like that when you thrust me in again. She pressed up with her hips and spread her thighs wider. She said,
"You stroke me slowly at first, teasing me."
He teased her, and she flung her head back. He rewarded her with kisses down her neck. He rewarded her by adjusting her this way and that, until he found a spot within her, a spot that rendered her pleasure fivefold. She cried out, "Then, sensing my need, you press in faster." His flesh slapped against her thighs, and the air was thick with the scent of their sex. She felt his balls brush against her nethers. When he was well seated, she squeezed, pulling an answering cry from him. "You press in almost too rough.
To know that I like this abuse."
She held his heart to his chest. She let their bodies hold that heart between them as she pulled him down against her, as she moved her hips to their rhythm, as they strove against each other there on the floor of their workroom, as the heated glass of herself melted into something new, as he released inside of her, Alpha to her Omega. After she made a pillow of him, a
and considered what to do next. He cast out ideas, as she wanted nothing to change. She silenced his babble with a kiss. "I will have the banns declared at the Church of the Blessed Mother in Santa Maria. They owe us, considering the assistance we gave them, with not only their stained glass, but the mystery of the disappearing Madonna.
But I know that you do not want to live as an Omega."
He waved at their workshop.
"You will lose all of this. I do not want to take everything from you."
"Which is why you will be marrying my twin sister, who is an Omega." She winked at him as she sat up and struggled into her clothes, then sniffing herself, declared that a bath was called for before finding a messenger to request that the banns be set. How exactly her brother knew to appear at the wedding, she did not care to speculate. "My crofty," she glared at him. He smiled benignly at her. "Hello, sister." "Father would be appalled." He turned to Giovanni. "And this is to be my brother-in-law." Charlotti almost cast him out, but he was a witness, and they needed those. Provosta Hodzoni was there sniffing over the romance of it. Some of her irregular color agents were there as well, misty-eyed. They were married under the stained glass that Giovanni had blown, and Charlotte had painted. The Madonna, Queen Donna of Heaven, smiled down benignly upon them, while a white dove flew into a glowing cloud. They were none too soon, as her heat came but a few days later, and having had the simulacrum of him many times, she wished to apply the true, although this time they withdrew to a cottage rather than a convent. It was the same, and it was different. The coupling was fiercer. The knot that gripped her was not a bladder, but flesh, that though she might struggle or cry at the pleasure at, was a stone within her channel that would not give way until she was well satisfied, until they were both exhausted with pleasure and could do naught but lie in their own rank sweat and smile foolishly at each other. So, not that different, really. If she had to change her garb and pretend to be her own sister for a time, from time to time, it was because people were idiots if they lost their second child. Giovanni was there to hold her in the secret of their loss. What a cloud on the sun that had been. When they had their third, Giovanni was there to hold her also. Their home teemed with their children, and Provosta Wila, their beta nursemaid, who they had saved from work in the municipal brothel, and deadly materials that they delicately dripped and blew into molten glass. What mattered was the deep red heart in pride of place before the window, that and the opaque white heart she'd cast, which, when the light came through the window, turned red by the light of the first heart, glowing in the sun. That and the collection of phalluses on the mantel. They had sentimental associations for her, even though now she possessed the original. The end.